This is the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. And I'm going to introduce you to a guy now who answers the question, what do Richard Pryor, Tom Snyder, Johnny Carson, Roseanne, and Dick Cavett have in common? The answer is Andy Friendly, who worked with all of those people and spent over 40 years writing, producing, directing, and overseeing television shows and movies as an executive, creating content for NBC and CBS and ABC and Discovery and PBS. He ran King World's programming for a while, Paramount, MGM, a bunch of others. Now he's written about his career in a new book called Willing to be Lucky, Adventures in Life and Television. And I've asked him to join me to talk about it. Hi, Andy. How are you?
Good, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Congratulations on a remarkable career and a great book about it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
I'll tell you the parts of the book that I really enjoyed, first and foremost, were the portions about Tom Snyder, a guy who I think has been kind of forgotten by American broadcasting, but was a very important part of it for a very long time, and I was a big fan of this colored teeny drinking guy. Where and when did you first meet him?
I first met him at Channel 4, WNBC TV in New York in about 1974. I was working as a young production assistant researcher on the local news there. I had grown up watching him in Southern California when he was the anchorman at KNBC, which is the big station out here in L.A. where I live. And I went to school at USC at the film school, and we would all hang around watching this guy anchor the news, which was not something college kids usually did, but he was so dynamic. And he had such a personality that we were all just mesmerized by him. He was the number one anchor in all of Southern California, dominant number one for a long time. So much so that NBC moved him to New York to do the same job at Channel 4 in New York, their number one market. LA is number two, of course, and try to revive their sagging ratings on the 6 and the 11 o'clock news in New York. So they brought him in. And he did exactly that. Within months, he turned the ratings around and made them number one. He also had a late-night show, which you referred to, called The Tomorrow Show, which he had just started on the NBC network about a year earlier. It was the first program. You were right to call him one of the greats and one of the pioneers, because NBC and any of the networks at that point didn't program past Johnny Carson and the Tonight Show past 1 o'clock in the morning. That sounds hard to believe given the landscape today, but they signed off, and I don't know how old the man you are, but I'm 66, and at that time as a kid growing up, Johnny's show would end and they'd play the national anthem and put a picture of the flag waving up until about 6 o'clock the next morning, and that was the end of the NBC network and all the networks until till the morning.
I do remember that. Oh, not just NBC, but as you point out, every TV station went off at 12 o'clock usually here in the Midwest, and 1 o'clock on the coast.
Hard to believe, but NBC and the executives there, Pat Weaver and some of the other smart guys, said, well, what if we program past that and go, let's try going an extra hour after Johnny. Well, what can we run that would be inexpensive but would capture that demo and the viewers of The Tonight Show? So they said, well, let's let this guy, we want to do an interview show because it doesn't cost a lot, and let's not have a band and writers like Johnny because that's too expensive. Who can we get just to come on in a simple set and interview celebrities and newsmakers and athletes and interesting people at that hour and do a good job? And they picked Snyder because he was obviously so smart and such a winner with the ratings on the news. And they started this show called The Tomorrow Show, which followed The Tonight Show and which preceded The Today Show. So Pat Weaver and the brass at NBC kind of had that concept. And Tom turned it into a huge success. It ran on NBC for about 8 years, won Emmys, and he really pioneered the late, late night. I get to meet him, to answer your question, when he was in New York anchoring the news, and I was a junior production assistant. Eventually, I was about 22, right out of USC Film School, and Eventually, they let me write the weekend weather and sports and try some of the other things, and I became a writer and a producer, and Tom liked my writing, and we hit it off, and he hired me onto the Tomorrow Show a couple of years later. There was an opening, and we became lifelong friends, and Tom, to your point, was one of the great innovators. He really understood the medium of television, and he could look right through that lens and reach out to viewers like he was in the room with you, and that was his appeal. He really captured viewers right by the throat. He'd stare them down with those eyes of his, and that dynamic voice and that great laugh that Dan Aykroyd imitated on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was just very, very good at what he did.
I'm always interested in process. So I'm curious, when Tom was doing the Tomorrow Show and you were eventually a segment producer on that show, which meant you booked the guests, and I don't know if you did pre-interviews with them or not, but as the host of the show, did he do research on them? You know, you would hand him paperwork the night before or early in that day and he'd read through that, or was he kind of an I'll just wing it a la Larry King?
He was more of in the latter category. You know, he was so smart that he didn't need a lot of notes. He was a great conversationalist, and he actually didn't want a lot of research and notes. I worked over the years in my career, as you nicely mentioned, with many, many talk show hosts, from Phil Donahue and Geraldo Rivera to Tim Russert and Dick Cavett and Roseanne and a bunch of others. And each had their own requirements and desires, and when it came to research and preparation, Tom was much more of a wing it kind of a guy. He was so damn smart, he didn't want to clutter his mind with a lot of notes. Basically, he'd ask for 2 pages, double spaced, and if you gave him any more, he'd get angry. He'd get ticked off at you. So, whereas a guy like Donahue, who you probably remember, or others, they'd want volumes. They want everything you could get them.
Yep.
So, different strokes. But Tom was a guy, basically, just give him the basics, tell him what the guest was up to, whether it was, and we got great guests for him. They all wanted to come on with Tom, whether it was John Lennon or Alfred Hitchcock or Orson Welles or 4 presidents of the United States. He knew what was going on with these people, and he wanted it to feel spontaneous. He wanted it to be much more like a conversation than a news interview, you know.
But the one thing
he was just great at that.
The one thing I know about Tom as a viewer, and I never knew him any other way, is he was not the biggest fan of rock and roll. I mean, this is a guy who on the air called Meatloaf Meatball. And I remember
That's
a show,
true.
And I don't know if you were working on the show at the time, when a group called the Plasmatics came on the show.
Yeah, Wendy Williams and the Plasmatics.
Wendy O. Williams, like, not to be confused with the daytime talk show host now.
Yes, exactly.
She was a mohawk-wearing shirt ripped off at any moment kind of woman who went on the Tomorrow Show, and I think as part of the act, didn't they either cut in half or blow up a Cadillac?
Yeah, they blew up a car in the studio. By that time, that's a funny story. Tom hated that. You know, he liked music, but he wasn't really into it. He was more of an old school Sinatra kind of guy. But, you know, he was in the 70s and the 80s and the dynamic music scene, and so we'd bring on a young John Lennon or a young Bono and the Edge from U2, and that he did his best. He didn't really care that much about it, and as you pointed out, he didn't like to do a whole lot of research. So that's where a lot of the comedy came from, when Aykroyd would imitate him interviewing Mick Jagger or something on Saturday Night Live, when Jagger was the host of SNL, and Aykroyd would get up and, you know, put on the leisure suit and the 4-colored hair wig and be smoking a bud and interviewing Mick Jagger, and he'd always get the lyrics wrong, or like you said, with Meatloaf and Meatball or whatever it was. But that he had a lot of fun with those guys. But later on, when they started bringing on rock bands to perform live, that wasn't really his thing. And they really changed the show in the last year. It was after I left, and actually Roger Ailes was producing the show. But and where they brought Rona Barrett in to co-host with them, it was like 1980, and the whole thing went right down the tube.
You know, those years of Tomorrow, Coast to Coast, I hope there's no video of that, Andy. Because
me too.
I mean,
let's lose those tapes.
I worked for NBC myself in the 80s and went once to a taping of that show, and you could see that when Rona Barrett was on the screen, Tom just hated it. Just wanted to get out of the studio. It was an absolute disaster. What did he think of Aykroyd's imitation of him?
You know, at first I think he chafed at it a little bit, but in time I think he learned to love it, because I think he knew that it was coming from a place of love and respect. You know, we taped the show right down the hall from those guys at SNL in the early years. They were in 8H and we were in 8G just down the hall at NBC at 30 Rock. The show had moved, you know, a couple times from LA to New York, but it was fun because we would tape our show every night, Monday through Friday at 5:30 to 6:30, or right around there, 6 to 7, I can't remember exactly. And, you know, starting Wednesdays, those guys were down the hall getting ready for the Saturday night show. So they'd be in rehearsals and starting to do early blocking. So we had the only prop bar, we call it. We, after the show, Tom liked to hold court on the, with the guests or whoever, certainly us, the young crew and the gang. And in one of the prop closets, he had a full bar. So the guys at SNL weren't dumb. They found out about it, and they suddenly became Tom's good buddies. And they would drop in Aykroyd, Belushi, Chevy, Gilda Radner, Bill Murray, and they'd come in for a pop, break up their rehearsals a little bit. And they'd hang around, and we had a great time with them. So I think Tom, at first, he didn't know what was going on with that impression, but then he learned to love it. The other guy that did a great Snyder was Harry Shearer. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember.
He was on SNL as well, and they were both great at it.
Andy, be honest with me.
Big laugh. Ha, 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 ha.
Right.
Ha, 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 ha. You know, the Snyder laugh.
But be honest with me, there were times when Tom must have had a pop or two before going on the air, not waiting for the prop bar to open.
Honestly, no, and I would tell you the truth on this, seriously, because there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, as I write about in the book, Ed Murrow, of all people, who is the most serious of news anchors and probably the greatest television news anchor ever, as portrayed by George Clooney in the brilliant film Good Night and Good Luck about the famous McCarthy program, Ed would get a little tight just before a live show and might maybe have a little pop just before he went on the air, and Clooney showed that in the movie. And there's nothing wrong with that. But Tom didn't. He didn't go for that until afterwards. He just wanted to be clear-eyed and sharp.
Actually,
but after? Yeah. Yes, sir.
Actually, Clooney made the movie, but he played your father, Fred Friendly.
That's correct.
David Strathairn was brilliant as Edward R. Murrow in that movie.
Yes, he was. And it was a tribute to Clooney that he could have easily taken the much more, the bigger part, the better looking guy, and he certainly is a great looking guy and could have played the Murrow part, but he wanted Strathairn to do it, and I think George wanted to concentrate on directing, which he did brilliantly. He also co-wrote the film. So he chose to play my dad, who was Murrow's producer, and he put on a few pounds to do that because my dad was probably 210 and Clooney's probably 160. And, you know, it's just credit to him. He really got into the part and made a brilliant film. All the more brilliant, as I write about in the book, because they did it in black and white. And the reason they did that, I don't know if you find this interesting, but they wanted to use the actual footage of the evil Senator Joseph McCarthy, the senator from Wisconsin, who the term McCarthyism was named after. A lot of your listeners are too young to remember, but if you get a chance, you guys should all watch that film,
yep.
Good Night and Good Luck, which was Murrow's sign-off. But he wanted to use the actual footage of Joe McCarthy from newsreels, and I asked him about that when I met him. He was very inclusive of my family and me in the making of the film. And I said, why'd you do that? He said, I couldn't cast an actor as evil as McCarthy was in real life in those clips. So I decided to make the whole film in black and white so I could use the real clips and use McCarthy. I found that very interesting.
Very.
And in the end, it led to a much more, I think, nuanced and stylish and dramatic film. You know, as you know, almost every film today is made in color.
Yep.
But in this case, it really worked.
Now, let's go to another project you worked on with another big personality. And I could easily talk to you for 3 hours, Andy.
So, I could, too.
Reading your book was just fantastic. And here's a part of the book that really got me. You produced the third Richard Pryor concert movie. He did Richard Pryor live, and then he did Live on the Sunset Strip, and then in 83 he did one called Richard Pryor Here and Now. And I wish I had time to talk to you about that for a long time, but I only have time for you to tell me one story, if you would, about the pinstriped suit.
Oh, God. Give me a cue. How much time do you have? Because I can tell this story in 10 minutes.
I have 3 or 4 minutes.
All right. I'll try to do it. It's his last concert film. We're shooting in New Orleans. We spent a whole year getting ready for it, shooting around the country at the Comedy Store and different clubs, getting ready. Couldn't have been nicer. He had a terrible rep. He had blown himself up in the last film, as you all know, with the freebase in the cover. Almost died. His reputation was for being very hard to work with. But when we got him, he was in a great place. He had recovered from all that. Couldn't have been nicer for a whole year. We finally get down to New Orleans to do the film itself at the old Sanger Theater. Over 3 nights we're going to record his concert. And Richard was the funniest, the best. If you ask Eddie Murphy or any of the comedians, Robin Williams, David Letterman, he was the best. So we were getting along great until the day before our first filming. He walks in with his brand new pinstripe white silk suit that he had just bought in New Orleans. And he said, "Guess what, guys? I found this. I'm going to wear this for the film." And we all went, you know, our alert signs went up because we know shooting video and film, you can't wear a white pinstripe suit because it's going to flare and strobe. And we thought he was kidding around, and we thought he knew that because he was directing the film. But he wasn't kidding. So he threw out the old suit, the green nice suit we had all agreed on with wardrobe, and he said, "You guys make it work." We said, "Richard, it's not going to work. The lights, the camera, the video chroma levels, it's going to flare. The audience will have a headache, and they'll be dizzy, and it's not going to work." He insisted on it, and he wasn't kidding around. We tried to talk him out of it. Jim Brown, the great football player, our executive producer, who was his friend, he couldn't talk him out of it. His lawyer, Skip Rittenham, who represents Harrison Ford and all the, he couldn't talk him. We end up taking this suit at 4 a.m. to a lady in New Orleans who tries to, we had talked to every wardrobe person in the world. We were talking to people in Paris. One, how do you fix this? Video people, the guys who do the Oscars. It wouldn't work. And Richard wouldn't budge. He said, I won't use the language, but you MFs better fix this. I'm wearing this suit tomorrow night. And if you don't, it's your ass. So we finally at 4 a.m, and this story has the added advantage of being true. We end up in an apartment of some crazy lady with beads and 5 cats because a tailor in New Orleans said, "Look, there's only one way you can do this. It's gotta be dyed. There's a lady I know who once made it work." We end up in this lady's apartment. She fills a bathtub with hot water and puts in a box of tea bags. I'm not kidding you. And now we have the suit, and we put it in the hot in the bathtub with the tea bags. It sits there for about an hour, and at 5 a.m. she hands it to us and says, "All right, take it out, let it dry. When you wake up in the morning, it might be okay." Well, we just thought our careers are over. This is it. He's going to fire us. The movie's never going to get made. We show up 9 a.m. Our wardrobe lady hands us the suit. It's all shrunken down 3 sizes. It's a muddy brown color. And we go back to Pryor, and we go, "We're sorry, Richard. We tried our best. We were up all night." And he was pissed. I mean, really pissed. He goes, "Well, I'm not showing up." Anyway, long story short, he shows up at 6 o'clock to do the show. And in the original suit, thank God, he cracks up. He's holding the suit, the wrinkled one, in his hand, walks out on stage, tells the whole story, and just has a great time and makes a big joke of it. But for those 24 hours, we literally thought we were going to be fired over.
What a life you have led. It's unbelievable. And we haven't even touched on, how do you handle Roseanne when she's doing a syndicated show? What's it like to piss off Johnny Carson accidentally? We didn't get into Dick Cavett, Charles Grodin, Charlie Rose, Phil Donahue, Tim Russert, Geraldo Rivera, Roger Ailes, and the list goes on. 40 years this man was telling great stories on television and remembering them to put down in the book, which is called Willing to Be Lucky, Adventures in Life and Television. Andy Friendly, what a pleasure it has been to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thank you so much, Paul. Really enjoyed it.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.